from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama delivered the last State of the Union address of his presidency last night. He focused less on policy and more on the way politics is conducted. He went for optimism and his faith in the everyman here in his big finish.
I believe in you, the American people. That's why I stand here as confident as I have ever been that the state of our union is strong.
It was at times a rallying cry, at times the president's style of straight talk, throughout a challenge to Republicans offering a harsher view of the country and the world. This hour on Point, President Obama's last State of the Union address. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did the president speak to you, for you, last night? Do you see the world, the country, as he describes it, or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Capehart from the Washington Post editorial board. He writes about politics and social issues for the Post-Partisan blog at the Post. Jonathan Capehart, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Also from Washington, Eliana Johnson is with us. She is Washington editor for the National Review. Eliana, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from New York, Douglas Brinkley joins us, presidential historian, professor of history at Rice University in Houston. Douglas Brinkley, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you all three, the whole country or some portion of it, watching last night. Here was the president with that optimistic note on America's nature and its future.
Our unique strengths as a nation, our optimism and work ethic, our spirit of discovery, our diversity, our commitment to rule of law. These things give us everything we need to ensure prosperity and security for generations to come.
But not everybody has easy access to all that. Here he tweaked the members of Congress and the Senate right in front of him in the hall.
It's not too much of a stretch to say that some of the only people in America who are going to work the same job in the same place with a health and retirement package for 30 years are sitting in this chamber.
But is the U.S. economy in decline? Absolutely not, said the president.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
A lot of speaking to Republican candidates on the campaign trail last night. Douglas Brinkley, we've got a lot to look at in this hour, but let me come first to you as an historian. What did you make of this address, the president's last of these what soon will be 8 years, the tone he set there, and how it compares with other presidents who stood there at this point in their presidency?
Well, I think the president struck the right tone. He had a lot of vim and vigor in his voice, a lot of energy. It was reminded one of the Barack Obama on the campaign trail. Most of his recent speeches have been dealing with times of tragedy, a mass shooting or an act of terrorism, so you have to be very stern and dour. Last night was the president at his best, I thought, able to kind of put his optimistic message forward. Recently, President Obama talked about his favorite president being Theodore Roosevelt, and he's recently been talking about FDR. And he's very enamored with Ronald Reagan. What all three of those presidents had was this sense of optimism. And that's what the president's speechwriters did. And that's what he delivered last night, was a real optimistic call that America's better days are ahead of us. It's a going back to the yes, we can message that the president brought into the White House way back in 2009.
Jonathan Capehart, there have been many times in recent years when the president did not look so optimistic. He looked kind of, you know, beaten up and dour when he would address the country. What's he up to exactly here?
Well, I agree with Douglas's assessment there. I mean, in the speeches that you're talking about, the times facing the country when the president spoke, when he was down and dour and beaten up, were troubling times. The economy was on its knees, uncertainty in the world, on the international stage. The president had to set the tone that he understood the challenges facing the United States at home and abroad. I think Douglas is absolutely right that the president last night used the State of the Union address to project forward. As he said in his speech, he wanted to talk about where he wanted to see the country in 5 years, 10 years. The key to that is he'll no longer be in office in 5 years or 10 years. He'll be out of office in a little more than a year from now. And one thing that I would counter what Douglas said, I would say to listeners to not go back to the Barack Obama of 2008 campaign, and yes, we can. You can go back to then State Senator Barack Obama and his speech to the Democratic Convention in Boston in 2004. Read that speech, and then you will see parallels to the man who eventually became president. In that speech, he told us what he would do if he would be president of the United States one day. And now here we are 12 years later and able to look back on that speech, and you will see parallels between that speech in 2004 and what he had to say last night.
Eliana, has he delivered on that promise?
You know, I think what the president was really trying to do last night was to bridge the gap between his promises and the reality that is out there. And so really to say that the economy is doing well despite the many anxieties, economic anxieties that people still have, that the administration is leading the path to peace abroad despite the many international disturbances that are happening, and that terror is a manageable problem despite its existence in the world. And so I really think he was trying to bridge the gap between people's many worries and really to say that despite people's anxieties, our problems are solvable. And I think that that was an enormous task and that we shouldn't underestimate the challenge that he had going into last night's speech.
I mean, there was a very clear note in here, Douglas Brinkley, that in some ways he has not been able to deliver on that promise of the united country. He spoke directly to it at one point, saying that one of his few regrets is that the rancor and suspicion has gotten worse instead of better. That clearly was not what he was holding out as the promise of an Obama presidency at the beginning. Let's listen to that.
It's one of the few regrets of my presidency, that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office.
Douglas Brinkley, what did you think of that moment? It seemed rare to me, a president comparing himself not necessarily favorably to giants, granted, but Obama came in on the notion of a unifying presence.
He does feel sad that he was not able to accomplish that. There are many reasons why. You know, part of it was the first year when he came in, the Affordable Care Act got pushed through with only Democratic votes. You had Republicans outraged by that. The Tea Party movement was born. But also, all presidents get a hard time. I mean, George W. Bush wanted to come in and be a compassionate conservative who united the country, and the country got very divided. This partisan divide is very real. What could President Obama done differently during his 7 years? It seems to me if he could have developed a better friendship with some of the people on Capitol Hill, he will tell you he tried. He went golfing with Boehner. You know, he would invite senators over to lunch, but there just never could become a working relationship with Congress and the White House. He, last night, was taking some of the blame for that, saying, I don't have the political skills of a Roosevelt or Lincoln in that regard. And so I do think it's a kind of a missed opportunity of his presidency. I would give him very high marks on many aspects of his White House tenure, but if you had to give a grade to the Obama and Congress, you know, you'd have to give it a very low grade, and you can blame Congress for it or the White House for it. But nevertheless, there's been a gridlock ever since the Affordable Care Act got squeaked through.
Jonathan, of course, he was giving a kind of scouring to Republican candidates, unnamed, in their messages on the campaign trail last night. But he was also, even before the speech, he talked with Matt Lauer on NBC. And said to Lauer, I think the most important thing I would say to an earlier version of myself would be to communicate constantly and with confidence to the American people the things I've done well during the campaign I've not always done well as president. Was there some kind of makeup late in the game last night for some of that here, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, you can't make up 7 years of less than valiant effort in one speech. But it is, we're seeing a president who is very thoughtful and reflective on his presidency and recognizing that, you know, there are things he could have done better in terms of his relationship with Congress, in terms of his relationship with Washington. But also, you know, we can focus on the president, what he could and what he did and didn't do as president. But at some point, we're going to have a deeper conversation about what was going on in Congress that made that relationship so fraught. We don't talk often enough about the invitations from the White House to members of Congress, particularly Republican members of Congress, that were declined. People who didn't want to be seen with President Obama for fear that it would incite a primary challenge. These are all things that were in the mix. Yes, President Obama definitely deserves some of the blame for the rancor, but not all of the blame.
Eliana, do you see Americans hungry for that message of optimism that was up there last night? Or is the hunger more anger and fear driven, more responsive to the very loud warnings of decline we're hearing on the campaign trail?
I think you've seen Donald Trump really tap into a groundswell among a large portion of the country that feels tremendously angry about issues of wide agreement among elites in both parties. And I actually think that you're going to see Donald Trump. I think it greatly benefits him, in fact, that both President Obama and Nikki Haley in her South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in her Republican response criticized him. And that's going to benefit him tremendously. I think there is anger about these broad issues of agreement by Republicans and Democrats, that there are people who feel they're not getting heard by members of either party.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's last State of the Union address, a message of optimism and appeal to the country's better nature from a president on his way out. You can join us this hour. Did you welcome President Obama's upbeat assessment of the State of the Union last night? Does it square with what you see at home and abroad? Do you welcome his call to get past rancor and be our best selves? Or did that sound too gauzy, too soft, given some of our hard realities? Eliana Johnson is with us, Washington editor for the National Review. Jonathan Capehart's here from the Washington Post editorial board and the Post Partisan blog there. And presidential historian Douglas Brinkley of Rice University is with us, author of Rightful Heritage, The Wilderness Warrior, The Great Deluge. You can join us, 800-423-TALK, the president with a very, very bright tone through much of this. But he acknowledged or said that when extreme voices get all the attention, there's trouble for democracy.
Our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get all the attention. And most of all, democracy breaks down when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter, that the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest.
There, a kind of lament, but throughout, the bigger theme, very much on the positive front, a faith he expressed at the end, Douglas Brinkley. He used these phrases a couple of times, that unarmed truth and unconditional love would triumph in the end. He talked tough in parts of this when it came to national security, taking out Osama bin Laden and using all of American power and so on. But unarmed truth and unconditional love, I guess those phrases taken from the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize speech of Martin Luther King.
There's seldom a moment when Barack Obama doesn't quote or find a way to bring in Martin Luther King to any major speech he gives, and last night was no exception. The whole idea of Martin Luther King, of the arc of justice bends in the right direction, is really a hallmark of all of his speeches. Part of last night's optimism message, even came across on grim problems. I mean, here, when you invoke cancer, which affects so many people, and he mentioned last evening that Joe Biden would run mission control, have a moonshot on against cancer. That's fighting spirit. That's saying we can tackle our tough problems. And so you saw last night a speech of the way Martin Luther King perhaps would have delivered one, which is the antithesis of a Donald Trump or Ted Cruz speech, where fear-mongering becomes the hallmark of what they do. This president is, as you started the program, kind of taking that higher angels of our higher nature approach. That would only make sense for a final State of the Union address. There have been State of the Union addresses where presidents have taken a kind of negative tone. I remember when Gerald Ford basically said the country's a mess during his first State of the Union. But when you're, you know, there is a Obama fatigue that hits the country. It's his last year. People are ready for him to leave office. That's only normal. But I would point out that he has another big moment of oratory coming, which is giving the major speech in Philadelphia for the Democratic Convention. And that one will he might be able to have more fighting words than he did this time around, where the message was, very clear optimism was the message.
Jonathan Capehart, a lot of this was anticipated as the president's framing up of the presidential election year 2016. Unarmed truth and unconditional love seemed like a way to bring his not just Martin Luther King's, but his own Christian background into play there. What about the overall effect of this speech in terms of how it frames, or his attempt to frame, the campaign, sort of high concept ground of the presidential campaign?
Well, I think in this speech, he's trying to remind the American people, probably the largest audience he will have in his remaining year as president, to remind them of remind us of who we are as a people, who we are as a nation, and to remember that as we go through this presidential campaign on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, as you know, we understand that when you are trying to get votes from the base, that you have to swing right or you have to swing left and probably say some things that you will regret in the general election if you're lucky enough to get the nomination. Hopefully you can swing back and be more moderate in tone. But things have gotten so far afield in terms of rhetoric and oratory, particularly from the Republican frontrunners, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, that I think the president felt compelled to, again, remind everyone of who we are as we approach one of the biggest decisions an American citizen can make, and that's walk into a voting booth and cast a vote for president. And if anyone thinks that the president was being partisan when he did that, all he had to do was listen to Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina in her Republican response. She matched the president in tone and toughness when it comes to the overheated rhetoric within her own party.
She saying there, we have to take our share of the blame for what's happened there. Eliana, what did you make of that? Nikki Haley, in her response to the State of the Union address, calling her own party out on exactly the grounds of rancor that the president made so much of last night.
You know, the phrase that jumped out to me was Nikki Haley discussing the mistake of falsely equating noise with results. She didn't name Donald Trump, but of course that's who she was referring to. And she really suggested that there's a civil war happening in the Republican Party. On one side are the loud voices of negativity. And in her very presence, she showed that that's not exclusively what the Republican Party has to offer. She was positive and uplifting. And she talked about overseeing the removal of the Confederate flag at the South Carolina State Capitol and talked about that as a symbol of division and bringing her own state together. And in that sense, I thought that there were a lot of similarities between her aspirations for what the Republican Party could be and what the president had to say. And just in her very presence, I think she offered a rebuke to what the president, I think in his own political way, wanted to suggest was what the essence of the Republican Party is.
It was a kind of canny echoing or anticipation of the tack that he took, but then with the sharp message that the GOP would do things better, would have better results ultimately. I want to look at national security much more, and there were plenty of digs. The candidates, we'll look at them as well. Our callers lining up to join us here. Jay in Dayton, Ohio. Jay, you're on the air. What did you hear? What did you think?
I actually heard a lot of echoing of my own sentiment in his speech. I've watched politics since I could watch politics. And in the last 8 years, the only way I can gauge the success of this presidency is in my own life. And I can say that in the last 8 years, the improvement financially and really socially in my world it's been increased and better. And when I watch the rancor and I watch the hate speech and the anger and the vitriol that comes out of the candidates, all I can think is that globally they're looking at us and thinking, great, divide and conquer. Look at them. They can't even get along with themselves.
Globally, the rest of the world looking back this way, the president certainly picked up on that as a theme, saying certain kinds of rhetoric weaken the country. Jay, I appreciate your call. Glad you feel in better shape. Joseph in Gardner, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Yes, one of the things that I wanted to say was that as a speech, I've got to give him high marks, pretty much an A+. But in terms of content, he was borderline disingenuous. He referenced the difficulties between the two parties and said that, you know, maybe a better president could have done it better. But he doesn't acknowledge the fact that a large percentage of it is a result of him. He doesn't acknowledge that there are no manufacturing jobs coming back. And that's in no small part due to him. He does something that we've seen a lot of these days with corporate and political structures. They acknowledge there's a problem, and then they broad brush that somehow there's someone somewhere responsible for it, but no one takes personal responsibility for what's going on. And he did that brilliantly last night as part of a really first-rate speech, but at no time did he acknowledge his role in the situation.
Eliana, what about it? The president certainly laid out bragging rights there when it came to the reduction in the unemployment rate, when it came to how the U.S. auto industry is performing now, and a number of other markers there. But when he acknowledged the ongoing difficulties Americans face in the economy, he did look at those more as structural, something bigger, longer term. You know, as you said throughout, I want to look 5-10 more years ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I think it's incredibly rare for a president to get behind a podium and take personal responsibility for problems that are happening or mistakes made. I think it's virtually unprecedented. But the case the president wanted to make was, of course, more vague. It was that problems still exist, but if we continue along the same path, they will improve. And the contrast, of course, being the Republicans on the campaign trail saying we need to change course, reverse course. And I think that's the difference. The president wanted to say, stay on course. I started us down the right course. And if you stay on it, that being said, I do think there's this gap between the picture the president painted of an economy that's all in all doing well, a global situation that's on the whole good, and the perceptions of the American people by and large, where there's still a general uneasiness about their economic situation and broad concerns, really, about the situation with terrorism writ large, both domestically and internationally. And I think he will have some difficulty bridging that gap. You know, a majority of people think the country's on the wrong track. And I think that was and will continue to be a real challenge for him.
Doug Brinkley, what about it? We've seen this latest poll out of NBC News and The Wall Street Journal saying 70% of Americans believe the country is on the wrong track. Was this the president's effort to jawbone people onto a right track perception, or is he just... Is that number, do you think, partly a result of all the negativity on the campaign trail, or is the president up against real skepticism?
Well, I think the president's up against real skepticism, and there's always the thought that America could be doing better. But what the president did last night is basically laying out what will be his presidential library in Chicago. All these presidential libraries, you have history displays. If you're going to begin the Obama presidency story, you would first do a display on the great inauguration, the first African-American elected president. But you would then want people to feel the Great Recession, how bad things were in 2009, how General Motors was about to collapse, how the stock market had tanked, and really show that, you know, almost like a Great Depression-like feel of 2009. And by the end of the story, if the economy could hold up for one more year, he will be able to claim that I got the economy going again. I was the person. We didn't do perfectly well, but many Americans judge the economy by unemployment index. He's brought it down to 5%. That's pretty good. Could it be 4% or 3%? Yes. But I think he's got a victory lap to take. My concern last night is that and as it was rightfully just pointed out, that is kind of a premature. It's one thing to take your victory lap mm-hmm. for your farewell address, but he's got a long year ahead of him here, and we don't know how the economy is going to perform. After all, it tanked on George W. Bush in October of 2008, right when his presidency was winding down.
Maybe take the lap while you can.
Well, that was the strategy last evening.
I want to turn to National Security a minute. He hammered away indirectly, but not very indirectly, on Republican challengers for the White House view on national security and ISIS, ISIL in particular. Here he was kind of going after Chris Christie and his characterization of a almost world war shaping up. The president saying that plays into the hands of the country's opponents.
As we focus on destroying ISIL, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands.
And here's more on the same theme.
They do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit.
Jonathan Capehart, he came again and again to the very hot language that's been on the campaign trail when it comes to ISIS. Was that, did it come across as a strong critique or as defensive on the president's part?
Both. It comes off as a strong critique and a bit defensive. Look, I think in that what we're seeing is sort of President Obama as President Spock in that. What we just heard, what you just played for everyone is an intellectual argument. The president is correct. ISIS does not pose an existential threat to the United States. But the people at home listening to the president, when it comes to terrorism, whether it's domestic or foreign terrorism, it's an emotional issue. It is something, whether it's an existential threat or not, is something that puts the fear into everyone. And so if you have the terrorist attacks of 2001, if you have what we hope are the lone wolf attacks, but ISIS-inspired attacks of San Bernardino, it's a very hard sell to the American people on an intellectual level that what's happening around the world will not eventually come here at home and then become truly an existential threat.
Ileana, is the president saying we have to chill out on this front? We can deal with this at arm's length in our own time and be assured of a long-term victory?
You know, I thought the president made the best possible case he could have for his approach to terror, which has been greeted with wide skepticism by the public at large. He said ISIS doesn't threaten our existence. I think that's a pretty low bar and not really the one Americans are measuring his approach by, because, of course, none of these lone wolf attacks threaten our existence and the country's existence. But nonetheless, they do induce a sense of great fear into the public. And I think what Americans are really measuring the president by is there more terror domestically in the country and internationally in the world now than when he took office, or is there less? And so I think the way he put the argument was one designed to benefit him. And at the same time, I don't think it was the standard by which most people are really measuring his success in terms of his administration's approach to international terrorism.
Douglas, do you think he puts Republicans back on their heels or on a different track here? Does a challenge like this last when it hits the cold air of the winter campaign trail, or do they go right on with their characterization of the conflicts and the U.S. position?
Oh, they go right on. We'll forget about the State of the Union address in about 48 hours. It's a frenetic campaign right now out for in Iowa and New Hampshire, and the media is going to, you know, forget about this State of the Union address. But it was, in the annals of the Obama presidency, a very beautifully delivered address, an important one, and it will read well in the history books.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're looking at the president's last State of the Union address last night with Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post, presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, Eliana Johnson of the National Review. You can join us. How do you think history's judgment of this president will shape up? Is it too early? He still has a year to go. He pounded on Republicans, not by name, but pretty clearly with his references last night, particularly on the front of ISIS and what they've been saying on the trail. Of course, Ted Cruz talked about turning the desert to glass, carpet bombing ISIS. The president saying last night the world would not accept that as a way for the United States to handle even this challenge.
The world will look to us to help solve these problems. And our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage.
There was some of that even in the response, the formal response given by Republicans through South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, saying, watch out for the angriest voices. Here was the Republican governor.
Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation.
But, of course, the Republican governor also saying that the president's record has fallen short of his soaring words. Lee in Detroit, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Lee.
Hi, Tom. I have a couple comments. First of all, I would just say I feel that Obama's biggest misjudgment was that he was naive coming into office about the extreme ideals of the people he would be working with, and it was much more difficult for him to get negotiated. Also, I would say, overall, I feel in the past 8 years, many things have domestically become more stable. But personally, I do feel that the inequality is growing, and the feeling that things are rigged and that the American dream is out of reach is still, I would say, even more so a feeling in my mind than it was previously. And then finally, the thing I want to say is I just feel that with he leaving office, we have missed a real opportunity. I feel Obama cares about the people he represents. And I really don't feel that in the current race, other than Bernie Sanders, who won't make it, that no one in either party really cares about the plight of the average American. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, Lee, and a couple of pieces there. But Douglas Brinkley, what about missing an opportunity here? I mean, that stirring optimism that we saw last night, the president himself acknowledging that he hasn't always been able to sustain that or communicate that during his time in office. But you look around the other contenders for the field, and nowhere else is that quite as sterling, the capacity to deliver quite that optimistic message and embody a certain kind of hope in his very presence as an African-American president, a breaker of old walls. When you look beyond this president, do you see others who can carry that torch? Do you agree with Lee that there's a missed opportunity here?
Well, look, Barack Obama's a two-term president, meaning not only did he win in 2008, but he went back at it and won in 2012. He has many admirers. I think he's kept his integrity factor with him. I think he leaves office in many ways a very strong president. He's going to have a very interesting ex-presidency. He'll sign a memoir about these years. That'll probably be the highest advance ever paid for a former president, and I think you're starting to see him lay out his post-presidential future. He constantly talks about climate change. He is the number one climate activist in America, and along with the Pope, probably in the world right now. And this issue of gun violence and getting background checks on guns runs very deep with him. After all, he has to go build this library in Chicago, and he's going to want to be the person who can work with, particularly with that city right out of the gate, to reduce gun violence. So we're not done with Barack Obama yet, but I will say I think we do give upward revisions to presidents once they leave office, so Barack Obama's going to look very well in history. And one of the ironies, I think one of his problems in history is Syria. And the fact that he drew that red line and then he didn't follow through on it, mm-hmm. and then he called ISIL the JV team to the New Yorker. However, maybe not going into Syria was the right thing. Maybe those were rhetorical mistakes, but a policy-wise of not getting engaged in that quagmire there, not sending in American troops, not overreacting, might be seen as a positive. But right now, it looks like his Middle East policy has been weak and ineffective.
You're our historian here. When he says maybe Lincoln or Roosevelt could have done better, of course, those are such mythic names at this point in many quarters that it absolves him at some level. But in fact, did they do better in their time at rallying the country?
Well, look, this president, yes, they were much better at horse trading. This president has a bit of a, you know, he's on a morality high horse. He doesn't particularly love politicians. He has a kind of ethical standard, a professorial bearing, a great constitutional lawyer. He has a set of values and beliefs. It what allows him to be such a great family man, a great father, great husband. He's not somebody who likes doing the backslapping, not somebody who likes to do secret deals with other politicians. But that's what a lot of being a president is. So I think that we have to look at Barack Obama as who he is as a person, and he's not Bill Clinton. But that's what was refreshing about him. We're going to have an opportunity now for a different type of president, whether it's a Trump or Cruz or Rubio or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. They won't be Barack Obama. His qualities, I think, were quite unique. And he did achieve something big on civil rights by promoting gay marriage and endorsing it. In one of his State of the Union addresses, probably his most famous, will be 2015, when for the first time he said the word transgender and lesbian, gay, you know, into a State of the Union address. So in that way, he's been a civil rights crusader for gay Americans. And we'll start seeing that as in a more upbeat way in coming years.
Aaron in Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. A few of my concerns are addressing earlier when you said that 70% of Americans are unhappy with the path that America is on. And I just wanted to say, I myself, as a 28-year-old mom of one who now stays home with her child, her husband has a solid job in the tech industry.
Okay.
And, you know, even as a middle-class citizen, it's hard to make it right now in the American economy, and I don't necessarily blame that on one side or the other, but I think our major concerns are, you know, a dying middle class. It's our children not being able to perform their math and science scores against other industrialized nations. It's no paid family leave, and it's also, you know, I constantly hear the right talking about, you know, democracy and freedom and, you know, America being kind of this beacon of freedom. And meanwhile, we're, you know, kicking out women and children who have fled here from South America, you know, refugees who have fled here from South America from terrible violence. And we're kicking out these women and children because we're saying, you know what, we're too afraid of terrorism, or we just can't take care of you. And I just, when I'm one of those 70% of Americans who say I'm upset with the path that America is on, I don't necessarily put that on President Obama at all. I've been very fond of many of his policies, but what I'm hearing in this new election, I'm not hearing either side saying we're going to stand up for middle class America. We're going to be that beacon of freedom and hope for people seeking asylum here. I just feel like we've really lost our core values, and I hear so much about core values from the right, but we don't even recognize that we're no longer a nation of freedom for people, because we're kicking out people who genuinely have need.
Aaron, we've got it. Interesting that with all that, you don't hear the president exactly addressing that last night, though that seemed like sort of the ground that he stood up to take on in his State of the Union address. Let me get one more right here from you. Thank you, Aaron. Dwight in Nashville. Dwight, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Okay. I wanted to make a comment, particularly to my disappointment that Obama did not mention the Black Lives Matter movement or black community at all in his speeches. As I listened to the speech, he stood up and spoke directly to the Muslim community. He spoke directly to the homosexual community. But he did not, he totally ignored and downplayed what African-American minorities have been going through for the last couple of years. You know, as I look back to the 2008 and 2012 campaigns, he benefited from the black vote, and it just seems to me that the black community has no capital, political capital. And I would say that during this election, I look to my voters up for grabs. I look to change over to anybody who would pay attention to what's going on. You know, all the injustices of black unarmed people being slaughtered on the streets, and as well as the majority of those police officers.
Dwight, I'm glad you raised the point. It is interesting, Eliana, early on in the president's tenure, people thought, well, he's not talking much about race. Maybe, you know, he's trying to establish constituency and support across racial lines. Here he is in his last State of the Union. And yes, he quoted very prominently Martin Luther King, but there was not a lot of attention, given how much it's been in the public mind and eye in the last year or two, to issues of the African-American community. What do you make of that, Eliana?
I think the president has always had mixed feelings and a sort of tentative approach about stepping into matters of race. And it's interesting because his own life story has been such an integral part of his success in politics and his unique ability to marry his own personal narrative with his political ideas and the American story. He's done that almost like nobody else. You see some candidates like Marco Rubio and actually Nikki Haley last night doing that quite successfully. But I think the president has always been tentative in not wanting to be defined by his race and by opining on matters of race and crowding out other voices. Yes, it was noteworthy that he did not step into the Black Lives Matter controversy last night, and I think speaks a little bit to his tentativeness on that matter.
He did, as Dwight in Nashville says, he did speak to the issue of how politicians are talking about Americans across religious lines, in particular about talking about Islam and Muslims. Here was the president on that front.
When politicians insult Muslims, whether abroad or our fellow citizens, when a mosque is vandalized or a kid is called names, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world. It makes it harder to achieve our goals. It betrays who we are as a country.
Jonathan Capehart, pretty tough there, and clearly a kind of Donald Trump, and maybe more in his sights as he delivers that kind of whopping on that front. But how do you think that plays? Are Americans nodding along with that, or are they in the frightened pushback camp?
They are both. I mean, what the clip you played fits right in with what Aaron was saying, the caller earlier, mm-hmm. about this view that people who are trying to come to this country, like fleeing oppression, you have candidates who are talking about kicking them out. That clip also talks to the international ramifications, his concern that the talk in the campaign trail, what that will have on his day-to-day existence as the commander-in-chief and leader of the free world. Then I want to push back on what Dwight had said. I understand his disappointment that the president didn't bring up Black Lives Matter in the State of the Union address, but to say that the president has been silent on that on those issues, I think is wrong. Now, while I agree with Eliana that the president was tentative when it came to race during his first term, anyone who's been awake and paying attention, particularly the last 12 calendar months, would know that the president has not been shy about talking about race. He has his My Brother's Keeper initiative, which comes directly out of his revulsion and concern about young African-American men and boys as a result of the killing of Trayvon Martin. How soon we forget about the president's eulogy in Charleston, which to my estimation, is probably the best speech, political speech and speech on race given by a president since the then candidate's speech on race in Philadelphia back in 2008. And again, back to Trayvon Martin, the president after George Zimmerman, the man who killed him, was found not guilty that July. I was in the White House press briefing room when the president surprised the press corps, went to the press briefing room and talked with passion and heart and unscripted about his view of what happened, what it means for the country, what it means for African Americans, and what it means for this country to move forward. So while it's nice for it would have been nice if the president mentioned Black Lives Matter in the State of the Union address, the fact that it wasn't there doesn't mean that it is not top of mind and not a priority for Barack Obama as president of the United States, and certainly for Barack Obama, former president of the United States.
Douglas Brinkley, John Favreau, former speechwriter for the president, called this President Obama's Morning in America speech, a response to the sort of down tone of Republicans on the campaign trail, and said, people, this is in the Times telling Peter Baker, people have never elected a pessimistic president who talks about America like it's a Mad Max movie. Do you think in some way the president laid down a marker that will put a break or some kind of slowing on that apocalyptic language?
I do. Barack Obama recognizes that optimism is the oxygen in America. And all the presidents that score high always have to make people think America's better future, better days are yet to come, whether it's John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. You've got to put that hope message forward. And I think he did it last night quite well.
The president saying he believes in unarmed truth and unconditional love in the speech last night as he came to the climax of his last State of the Union address. Very grateful to all three of you for helping us look at it today. Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University. Great as always to have you, Douglas. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Eliana Johnson with the National Review. Thanks for coming on, Eliana.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Capehart at the Washington Post. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Tom, thanks again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.